Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Bernhard Trout is on faculty at MIT, where he teaches their AI and ethics course. His students explore a vast array of ethical questions, ranging from how we can align our aims with autonomous systems to whether the future of AI is an existential threat to humanity. Bernhard, thank you for joining me today. It's so great to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So we're back to the school year. This is definitely not a typical summer. How did you end up spending yours?
Well, for some reason, I think I spent most of my summer on Zoom.
Yep, as many of us did.
Yeah, it's really strange. I have some theories about this, what I'm about to say, but it seems like having gone essentially all virtual, practically all virtual, has made us busier. It hasn't made us less busy.
Yeah, I can vouch for that.
I think maybe because we just agreed to do more and just kind of propagates throughout our week.
Yeah, well, I hope you got in some vacation time.
Not really. Did a few things here and there on the weekends, took some nice hikes and got out some fresh air, but
good.
That's about it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's go ahead and dive in. So is the future of AI an existential threat to humanity? Is this a question that's up for real debate? And what have you been discussing with your students and colleagues on this topic?
Well, it might be. It's up for debate. Of course, no one that I know of can predict the future. It is something of a concern. Maybe it's a very serious concern. I would say that certainly the technology is a major issue, but perhaps a more important issue is how well we face that technology. What is our character? What are our politics going to be? How is the human race going to address things going forward, address AI, address technology? And if you indulge me for a moment, I just express two other things. So, you know, starting in the 50s, the big existential threat was nuclear weapons. And it's still bothersome. I know it was very bothersome up until the 80s. It should still be bothersome now. But if anything, the threat's gotten worse, maybe with the fall of the Soviet Union, that aspect has gotten less. But the threat is there and is propagated. And the other thing is, in 2000, I remember the big thing on everyone's mind was cloning. Everybody was worried about cloning, and there were committees, and there were laws, and all kinds of stuff. And I've heard almost no talk about human cloning recently. That was going to be the big threat that was going to bring down humanity. So I think AI is something that we're going to certainly need to address into the future. But we also have to think about, as human beings, certain things are on our mind, certain things that are in society at this given time. And we should focus on those to some degree, but maybe we shouldn't be worried to that great of an extent of those things.
So the reason why it would be an existential threat is what humans choose to do with this potentially very powerful tool in their hands.
That's right. What we choose to do with it, but also what we want to be as human beings, what we want to be as a nation, the United States, and as human beings in the world, what's important. And technology can allow us to easily forget what those things might be. And maybe in a certain way, by forgetting, it changes what our aims are and what we think is important as human beings. And so we have to be careful and be wary about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So regardless of where we end up on the question of whether it's an existential threat, there is a host of thorny ethical issues that arise. Some of them, like bias and privacy and the impact to labor markets and vulnerable populations, are things that we're actually addressing on this podcast and other episodes. So for today, I'd love to take our talk in a different direction to kind of draw on the ideas that I know you're also thinking about in your class. So when I was a freshman at Harvard, I sat in on the first class of justice taught by Professor Michael Sandel. And he posed the trolley cart problem to all of his students. And then years later, when this course became available online for the whole world, it also began with the trolley cart problem. It's such a classic question that's come up over and over, especially now that we have autonomous vehicles. But no one has an answer to it. In some ways, it's a question that doesn't have an answer, and we've never been forced to. But now that we are getting closer to deploying autonomous systems, we are going to have to make some of these choices. And if you disagree with that, I'd love to hear. But, you know, posing the question to you, if a vehicle on the road has to decide between accidentally running over five people or diverting to a side road and deliberately running over one bystander, how do we program the vehicle to make this choice?
So, okay, this is a key question, of course. It is not a new question, though.
No, absolutely not.
It is perhaps the oldest question having to do with, you know, the human race. It's certainly been an issue in terms of war. You have to sacrifice certain soldiers, certain part of an army for certain strategic goals for the rest of the army, for the nation. And there are different ways in which that's been handled throughout history. More recently, corporations have to make kind of strategic decisions, and they have to sacrifice certain things, certain aspects of their aims for others. They have finite resources. You can kind of think of this as having finite resources. These are utilitarian questions. The interesting, I think, aspect of this, and the way to think about it, is engineering, including computer science, I'm kind of lumping that in, but engineering, science together are essentially utilitarian. So in engineering, there's always a trade-off, and you're trying to optimize something. And you have a certain equation, and maybe a very long equation, and then you try to find some maximum or minimum or whatever. So that's engineering, including the autonomous vehicle issue. However, as human beings, we don't really do that. And I was preparing for this podcast, I was thinking about maybe you or some of the listeners have had this experience. Have you ever gone and wanted to buy something? I don't know, maybe it's a chair or just something, car, maybe a little bit more fancy and whatever. And you put together a spreadsheet and you put together criteria. Maybe this is just, we do this at MIT, I don't know. But you put together all the criteria and you
and
say-
And you just make your own decision afterwards.
Yeah, and then right, at the end of the day, you make your own decision. You say, you know, it says I should buy this one, but I really want that one. So I buy this anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think this is why we're uncomfortable with these decisions, because as human beings, we're not actually utilitarian creatures. Some aspect of us is utilitarian. So there's a tension, in other words, between engineering, between therefore computer science, how we operate as human beings, what our aspirations are, and how we make decisions. That was a broad answer to kind of put that more specific question in context, but yes. And so now we have to face these. And the autonomous vehicle question also is not new, but it's new to us. So one thing that people don't think about is highways are not infinitely safe, as we know. Nothing is, no products are. And there's a certain formula that the Department of Transportation uses to determine safety criteria for exit ramps and for all kinds of other things. And that's actually a utilitarian question. So this question about autonomous vehicles is not new. It's been out there ever since there's been a Department of Transportation anyway. But since people have been driving, they've had to make questions. And since people have been making products, maybe ancient ships have had a similar issue. You know, how do you balance safety, the cost, with the desire for trade or the need to get from one place to another?
So how would we address this? Like, how is the programmer a Tesla that has to make these decisions for the autonomous vehicle before they deploy them? Like, what should they do?
Well, at the end of the day, I think these vehicles are going to have those algorithms programmed. They may not be that simplistic. They may be broader. So I have different versions of my ethics class, including an AI version. I'm actually from a chemical engineering department. So the class originated in chemical engineering, although I do machine learning for pharmaceutical design. So I start out with classic examples for my chemical engineering students, like how safe should a chemical plant be? I mean, there are lots of examples of disasters at chemical plants. And the first answer the students give, well, it should be perfectly safe. Then we get into some of the engineering aspects and we realize quickly it can't be perfectly safe. So then how does the criteria of safety, how is that actually determined? I think at the end of the day, a lot of that is determined by what we view as important in society. And so, you know, speaking of the US, other societies may view things differently. We think safety is important, but there's still going to be accidents, so they can't be infinitely safe. And so there's some trade-off in their regulations about how safe cars should be and certain criteria about safety. Airbags came up some decades ago. So I think at the end of the day, that decision is going to be made by what's acceptable, in this case, in the United States. Maybe there'll be some generally acceptable standards across the globe. And we don't know exactly what those are right now, but I think that's going to be ultimately what's going to determine those criteria.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And we see that in law, the reason why we have federalism, we have some laws that are promulgated by the federal government, and then everything else is reserved to the states, because the belief is that at the local level, people know what their values and mores are. So that's a really interesting way to think about AI safety and these questions too. You're right. It is cultural to some extent. It depends on how much we value the individual over the society and vice versa. So picking up on that point, what about those cultural differences and thinking about ethics? Like, where have you seen those come more starkly into play? Are there areas of ethics where you feel like, okay, now we're really seeing a gap between what different countries or different cultures are thinking about in terms of ethics, and where it might be hard to reconcile them?
Well, I think I can answer that in general terms, not necessarily from an AI perspective, but in general terms, I think the less wealthy a society is, it gets back to essentially this war analogy. It depends how important it is to get to some end goal. And if we need to get there faster, because there's always a trade-off. That's the other thing that we forget about. And, you know, again, I'm from chemical engineering. I did research in climate change. That's another topic that we bring up in some of our versions of the ethics class. And it's important to realize that none of these questions occur just alone. They always occur in a broader context. Now, with the vehicles, it's evident that, you know, lots of people die in highways. We want to reduce those deaths. And maybe that's the criterion that we use. But in a broader perspective, if we spend more resources, however that may play off in terms of making certain safety decisions, we have less resources for other things. I mean, just as an example, right now, we're unfortunately in the age of COVID. So a lot of resources are going into addressing COVID. I think we all think for the most part, that's a good idea, but there are also people getting sick for other reasons. So we're still addressing those, but maybe less so because a lot of our attention and resources have gone to addressing COVID. So again, broadly speaking, I think it's important to think about these ethical questions in the broader context. And it's really easy to kind of get down to these very specific trolley problems. But I think we have to also, in thinking about those specific questions, and at the end of the day, the programmers have to make those algorithms and have to program them in a particular way. But in thinking about that, we have to think of the broader trade-offs too. And that's very difficult for us. As human beings, we tend to focus on certain things, and it's harder to think about the broad picture.
Absolutely. And then you add in the extra complexity of different government systems and decision makers and how laws and regulations are promulgated. And it's a very complicated arena. How would you answer the question of whether machines can think and reason? And what would be the significance of that for ethics and AI?
I'm glad you asked this question, because one thing I also wanted to say about teaching ethics, as I mentioned, I've taught many versions to different students. What's interesting about AI is that it immediately gets you to fundamental questions. So we talked about safety. I think that's important, and there may be trade-offs there. There are trade-offs one has to address. But in terms of AI, get right to the basics, the foundational questions, like what does it mean to think? And I would say that there's a tremendous lack of clarity, maybe in general, but certainly in the AI field about what that means. One of the reasons why there's a lack of clarity is because I think it was obfuscated from the beginning. So one of, I think, the most fascinating papers, and I have students read it, is the original paper from Alan Turing in 1950. It's called Computing, Machinery, and Intelligence. And in that paper, of course, he talks about the Turing test, but he makes the case for doing research in artificial intelligence eventually. So in machines that can think. But the way he does that is maybe defining thinking in a very specific way. So he actually explicitly says the question about what thinking is just a ridiculous question. You can't address that. All you can do is say, can a machine seem to think? And so seeming to think is what thinking is. And I think that in the AI field, that tends to be how AI researchers and programmers tend to think.
I've heard multiple of my colleagues say the same thing. It seems to be doing it. We're not really sure.
We're not really sure.
But if we're not really sure and it seems to be, then maybe we assume that it is.
Exactly. Although, is that a good assumption?
Right.
And that's why I think it's important to go back to the beginning. So we talked about utilitarianism and why we're uncomfortable with that, because we're not really utilitarian creatures. We're partly so to some extent, but we're not creatures who are utilitarian. We don't make these calculations. These are machines that make calculations all the time. And they have a certain architecture. They're programmed. They are products. They're technological products. They're products of art. They're artificial. And part of our challenge in addressing this issue, the question that you just posed, is that we are having a harder and harder time distinguishing what's natural from what's artificial, or maybe respecting nature in a certain sense, or making nature the basis for our guidelines.
Can you give an example of that?
Right here. This is the perfect example in terms of thinking. So at MIT, all the time, my colleagues, students say, well, we're just a machine and there are certain mathematical processes in our brain and that's how we operate. And yeah, maybe we're analog machines and maybe the architecture is very different from what is silicon, but it's essentially the same thing. However, I don't think that's the case, actually. We are products of nature, and there might be a case to be made. We talk about this in our class. I think there is a strong case that we didn't make ourselves. And so it may be actually impossible, logically, for us to fully figure out ourselves. Whereas in a certain sense, these machines are well-defined. We may not know exactly how they're going to operate because they're highly nonlinear, but they do operate in, you know, some kind of nonlinear mathematical way. We don't really operate in a nonlinear mathematical way. We tend to operate more linearly, so we can't actually necessarily predict what they're going to do without performing lots of experiments and development. But for us, I would say that we are not analogous to these machines. Now, why is that significant for ethics? Well, one of the things that always comes up is human-machine interfaces. If we're actually machines and we operate via mathematical processes, which again, I think I can make a strong case why that's not actually true. But if that's the case, then maybe it makes a lot more sense for us to just enhance our own internal mathematics in various ways via machines. However, if we're not, we're products of nature and we didn't make ourselves, we might not be able to understand ourselves. We may change ourselves in a way that at the end of the day is not desirable. In other words, we're making up a certain criteria for what the human good is, for what our good is, without having fully thought it through and without actually being aware, perhaps, of what we might be doing and how we might be, let's say, decreasing our options going forward, if you want to put it that way.
How would we be decreasing our options?
If we think that we're nothing more than mathematical machines, maybe different architecture, substantially different architecture, then we might start acting in certain ways via social media. Those might be primarily our interactions going forward. Maybe they actually are primarily our interactions, especially now. And that could have detrimental effects because we could actually manipulate how we act, how we interact, what our choices are going forward, how we change our architecture by interfacing with silicon, essentially, in a way that at the end is detrimental and doesn't make us happy. So if we're trying to use AI and products of technology to have a better world, to make ourselves happier, how do we know this is actually leading to us being happier? And just one more example, this unfortunate situation that we're in with lockdowns across the country and generally having to worry about, you know, our daily routine in a way that we never had to, is that I think we realize how important actual human interaction is above and beyond, you know, this kind of computer interaction that we're doing now. And we miss being with our friends. We miss going out. And that's one of the reasons why it's been difficult to contain the pandemic, is because people are just doing this. You just can't stay home in your basement unless you're an MIT professor, in which that's what you do anyway. You usually don't, just people want to get out and interact. Now, if we go forward, we could actually forget about that, right? I mean, there's this old question, would you rather be, well, not very happy, but, you know, face reality the way it is, try to overcome it, try to strive to be better, to accomplish things and to create value, to create worth? Or would you rather just be laying in bed with, you know, chemicals pumped through your body, which makes you feel euphoric? People don't usually choose the latter option.
It sounds like the Matrix.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the worry. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a long journey down the answer to your question about what's important about can machines think? Well, if they can't really think, but we can, we're superior to these machines. They can calculate a lot better than us. They can do a lot of things a lot better than us. But a bulldozer could do a lot, a plow, right? From, you know, however many thousands of years ago, could do much better than human beings. That's why we employ it. But that doesn't mean that we should try to become more and more like these machines. Maybe it means that we have to intentionally try not to become more and more like them. Try to use them for what they're good for and understand what human beings can do above and beyond these machines that is more important.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that, as you mentioned, artificial intelligence, just the fact of it makes us confront what it means to be deeply human. You know, I think about this a lot in the art space in particular, because it does feel to me that art being, you know, a way of plumbing the depths of human emotion and the human soul, like those are things that can't be replicated by machines. And yet we do see more and more, you know, AI art type applications out there. And so I'm interested to see where all that goes.
Well, music, we know that machines can develop music that will trick human beings. They think it's by a human composer. And it's probably not quite that way yet with the visual arts, but I don't see why in the future that can't be the case. And this is an argument that I make. So towards the end of the class, we talk about the Sistine Chapel, one of the most, you know, amazing works of art. Could machines have developed something like the Sistine Chapel? Well, I don't know. Certainly the technology would have to advance a lot more. But maybe we should step back and pose what these machines actually do. So they're really a nonlinear algorithm that takes in data, processes it in a certain way, and then outputs certain products. Could it create something like the Sistine Chapel or Pietà or something like that, or even Picasso, if you want to choose something modern, by taking in existing data? Or is there some kind of break that has really happened? And this goes back to your question. You got down to the heart of it, or the foundations of it. What does it mean to think? Well, if thinking is just a mathematical formula or some product of a mathematical formula, then maybe these machines can create art as well as any human being, if not much better. If not, then it may be that there's something in creativity that cannot be reflected in machines. The machines might be able to fool us. They may be able to inspire us in certain ways because they could program our reactions and try to bring out certain reactions. But at the end of the day, they cannot be creative in the way that human beings can be creative. And if that's something of value, which I think it is, that's something that we risk losing. And that's where this existential threat may come in, by us forgetting what's important and letting ourselves kind of lost in the ocean of technology and artificial intelligence.
Well, I'd love to talk more about one of the questions that you talk about in your class along these lines. How do you think AI is going to change social interactions?
I guess in a certain sense, social media isn't quite AI, but it's certainly related, and it's certainly going to be more and more related. And it's applied in trying to match people and whatnot. I think that it will certainly affect and continue to affect social relations. You were kind of asking that in very broad terms. So I guess we can look at the spectrum. It will affect how you do searches and therefore how we connect with people on the internet. I mean, LinkedIn I'm sure, employ some kind of AI and there's some kind of connections made. Even if it's not AI, even if it's just very basic, you're connected with this person and this person is connected with the other person. But there's going to be some algorithm which judges how you should be connected, in this case, professionally. It's certainly the case in terms of personally.
That's interesting. It's something we just take for granted, who we're connected to today through our social media, things that have been recommended to us by the algorithm. It's just our life. I don't know that people are really thinking about an underlying AI shaping that.
And, you know, even if it works well, how do you judge that? Because you may just get used to a certain kind of interaction. You've forgotten about what was most important in the past. You've gotten used to this. I think human nature does come out. And again, that's been demonstrated here. As much time as we spend on social media and Instagram and whatever else, we want to interact with human beings. And you've probably had this. Many of people can't get together with friends, so we have kind of a Zoom party on Saturday or whatever. It's not really the same, not anywhere close to the same. But AI could help facilitate those things and help facilitate interactions, help facilitate meeting people who become partners.
Yeah, it could facilitate meetings of people we wouldn't normally connect with, which is a positive. And then it could also exclude people who we would normally have run into. Maybe it changes who our neighbors are.
Yeah, it's good that you brought up neighbors as even the people you live next to. It used to be we lived in a little neighborhood, you know, way back when, and we'd interact with the people in the neighborhood. Probably still do today. You see people in the hallway in an apartment or in the neighborhood, if you live in houses in the suburbs or whatever. But generally, our social group is not the people we live with in a neighborhood or in an apartment complex. It's people, maybe certain people from work or certain people that we've met through other activities or online. And that's definitely going to affect it. So that's happening now. But there's another maybe extreme that's happening now, which is having AI robots as actually our companions.
Yes. And I'm actually interested in hearing your thoughts there. I know in your class, you also talk about love and AI and whether it's permissible to love an AI or an AI robot.
That's right.
I'd love to hear more.
Well, you can look at videos and other things online and you can see what's out there, what technologies are out there. Some of those are, I think, actually maybe not just permissible, but extremely helpful. I'll give some examples, maybe from a medical standpoint. Particular people with dementia or Alzheimer's, it's been found that companions that do have AI programming, maybe dogs or whatever, for you or me, they wouldn't be very interesting except maybe just as a subject of investigation. But they're very helpful to some of these elderly people with these kind of diseases. And you know, even if they can't even interact with their family because it makes them angry, whatever. But these AI advanced stuffed animals essentially are very helpful in a way that inanimate ones and ones that don't react won't be. So that's, I think, not just permissible, but probably very helpful in having a better quality of life. The other extreme, and there's been movies about this, you've probably seen Her as one of them. Ex Machina is another.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites.
Okay. Why is it one of your favorites?
I think maybe it's partly because it's set in a world that I live in, right? The Silicon Valley world and how it implicates privacy questions. You know, I think everything that went into fooling the protagonist is all the things that we're worried about in artificial intelligence.
That's right. Lots of ethical questions there. Well, one of them that comes up in the movie, and hopefully won't spoil it if some of your
right.
some of the listeners haven't seen it, but one of the issues that comes up is these bots, should they be treated like human beings? This goes back to your question about what does it mean to think? So if we're just machines, then that means machines are like us, and that means these machines should have certain rights maybe. Maybe even more rights than us in a certain sense. They can do things better than us. I think that's worrisome for the reasons I mentioned, because I actually don't think they think in the way that we do. I think we're bringing down what we mean by thinking, saying that it's just a mathematical process like these machines are. But it relates to this subject of, is it permissible to love a robot? Well, if you think that we're just maybe carbon-based instead of silicon-based mathematical machines, which aren't as good, then maybe the answer is yes. Although that seems a little strange for us now, we get used to it. I don't think that even a decade ago or so that we thought we would all have smartphones. 2 decades ago, even if you watch some of these old reruns, you know, people had to drive around to find a phone booth. So we never think about that. Well, we could forget about, again, what's important about human love and human interactions and lose ourselves in some perhaps distorted notion of what is ideal, right? We're all very flawed creatures, and part of what we're searching for is something beyond us, something that's ideal. That's what Eros is trying to find something beyond us, something greater, something we're striving for. And we maybe accept imperfections while seeing certain things around us that are greater than us, in our partners, in our erotic attachments. And it seems to us, I think, for the most part, strange that one would fall in love with a machine. And if you look at the bots that are available, you can make judgments about how their forms were selected. But this could distort our reality and actually lessen to a greater degree our human experience and human interactions. And part of this existential threat, you might be familiar with Huxley's Brave New World. It's been on the reading list in ethics really since it came out. And what if, like Matrix maybe, human beings are born in a factory and then all our partners growing up are bots, our teachers are bots and our partners are bots? Will that lessen our experience? I think it's likely that that would.
Yeah, or even as basic as what Ray Bradbury does in The Veldt, where the children fall in love with their AI safari world, right? They love playing in that world. It's basically a really enhanced video game, and they love it more than they love their own parents. And they make a choice about that in the end, which I won't spoil. But these are important questions, and I feel like science fiction writers have been thinking about them for a long time, but they are slowly becoming more of a reality for us.
That's right. And this is the worry. This is what I think is the existential threat, the important existential threat. I don't think that's what Elon Musk meant exactly when he talked about it. We still have to think about these creatures with, I don't know, millions of times better processing than we have. They could just crush us because we're like plants to them. That may be one thing. But maybe a bigger existential threat is that we forget about what's valuable in reality and lose ourselves in unreality, is this example you just mentioned. And that happens with video games. I mean, kids get lost in these video games, and that's a big problem. I mean, people have to go to rehab for video game addiction, essentially, ruins their lives. But that's where we could all end up. That's the worry. That's what I think is the existential threat, getting back to your original question.
Right, which is one of yours as well. So your AI and ethics course, like I think each of the weeks that you have there could easily be an entire podcast episode and more. But I did want to pick up on just a couple more of the questions in the time that we have left. Should AI be used to predict crime? That makes me think, of course, of Minority Report.
Right.
What have you been thinking about in your students as well?
So we talk about that, and I'm certainly not a criminologist or a legal expert. You would know a lot more about the legal issues than I. But from my lay understanding of the legal aspects, the law is not a mathematical field. It probably shouldn't be a mathematical field. And it is worrisome. I mean, one of the issues is predictability. Many of the listeners might be familiar with this famous COMPAS study, or COMPAS program, I should say, to predict recidivism in jails in Florida.
It's a big area where bias is a problem.
It's a big area where bias is a problem. But I want to maybe let you think about it in a very different way, which is, I'm not advocating a particular approach by saying this, but I'm trying to open up a way of thinking. Should we think about this at all? Should that be a criterion? So if you commit a crime and you serve some time, a couple of years, 3 years or whatever, and you're let out, maybe you're on parole, whatever the procedure is, should your being let out be based on a prediction, whether it's from a computer or just from human beings who are experts reviewing your case? Should that be one of the criteria? Now, certainly public safety is one of the criteria. And so somehow that has to be, but should it be quantified as such? And do we want to be quantified? And I guess you mentioned Minority Report again, maybe not to spoil it, but you know, should we be put in jail because we have a 99.99 chance of committing assault? And is that the purpose of being put in jail? And I think it goes back again to this really foundational issue of what it means to be a human being and therefore what it means to think. If it's a mathematical process, then it's predictable, at least in a probabilistic sense. So the question is, are we just doing the predictions wrong? Or is the approach of prediction as such, using AI algorithms, using algorithms, is that approach itself intrinsically problematic? It may be useful to some extent, but isn't intrinsically problematic. Well, again, if we're just mathematical entities, mathematical beings, then maybe applying mathematical algorithms to our behavior.
To our human systems. Society,
mm-hmm. To our human system, right.
Yep.
Our human eye systems. Maybe that's not as big a problem as it is if we are not mathematical creatures. We are, again, product of nature. Maybe for some of the listeners, products of God, products of nature's God. And so if that's the case, maybe we have to think about these problems differently. I mean, there's going to be a utilitarian calculation, but how do we think about the utilitarian calculation from rights? Intrinsically, rights is not something that's mathematizable.
I think it's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah. So by mathematizing it, we're really distorting it. So prisoners should have rights. They do have rights. And so we have to be very careful about, I think, applying those. And again, I want to emphasize that's above and beyond how good the algorithm is. So we can say, oh, the algorithm just wasn't good enough. Let's make it better. In 5-10 years, it'll be better, whatever that means. Is applying this approach actually the right approach? And again, you like the way of putting it in terms of our rights. And so I think that's the way of thinking about it, is the approach. How does that affect these non-mathematizable aspects of human beings?
We've talked about how your AI and ethics course is actually the only one at MIT right now. And I'd love to hear a little bit more just personally, what led you to start the course as well as the work that you've done over the years as a director for the Society of Engineering and Ethics? What's motivated you as a technologist to really delve deeply into this field of ethics? And what do you think success is going to look like in this field? What do you hope to see?
So I was an undergraduate at MIT also, and then I did grad school at Berkeley, always in sciences, engineering/science. But I've always wanted to get down to the more fundamental questions. And so I studied quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics. And really from the beginning, I was interested in more broader philosophical questions, including ethics. Ethics is really a very broad question because it's about how we should live. It's about what makes us happy. And it's about the right kind of politics. It's very related to politics anyway. So I was always interested in that. And when I came to MIT, I said, you know, I want to introduce our students to these topics more, but in a technical context. So we have a strong humanities school, humanities, arts, and social sciences, and students take actually 8 classes from that school. But they're always separate classes. Maybe a few are cross-listed. For the most part, they're separate. I wanted to introduce this to engineering students within an engineering context so they can think about it within their own lives, but also as engineers. And so I started this as just ethics for engineers in 2009 with a colleague who was on sabbatical, who's in political philosophy. And I just continued that and recently introduced an AI version. We started introducing different case studies. We're introducing a biotechnology version this coming year. And so it's just been a passion of mine. You could maybe think about it as a youthful foible, which didn't lessen in middle age. So,
it's definitely not a foible.
So I'm very dedicated to this topic.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'm sure that your hundreds of students are benefiting. Well, Bernhard, I think what our conversation shows is that there are really no easy answers to many of these questions. There's so many viewpoints, and some of them I think we can probably agree and converge on some right answer, but for the most part, most of them have multiple answers. And what's encouraging to me is that there are so many great minds thinking about them. And over time, I'm hopeful that we will come to good decisions. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast, and really look forward to good things to come.
Yeah, thank you very much, Abigail, and all the best with the podcast, and do stay in touch. This is a very important subject, which I intend to be involved in for the foreseeable future.